7th State of Ohio versus Timothy Coleman. This is Kochar.
Because that's officer was a drug dealer, he had seen him inside and he was wrong. That gave him the same motive, knowing that he had asked him home.
And then what's the trial of a counsel strategy, strategizing the case that he could get foster, which is formed on a threat to the killer? Was that less credibility to my client threat to the killer, therefore we don't want to put foster on? Is that the heightened factor? You form on somebody, we're going to kill you and take the order to see if Robert's on your own client, and there's a strategy to do that.
I don't think you're in this case, Ron, because the defense counsel offered up Charles Foster in your opening statement as a possible alternative suspect. They told the jury that Charles Foster or James Rose or any one of a number of drug dealers could have committed his murder. That was the strategy, that was the theory that they were presenting to the jury. They simply did not back it up with that.
Is there anything in the record that indicates that Foster was available, he had opportunity and means at the time this was committed?
No, Your Honor, there's not. There's nothing to say he wasn't on.
Okay, so we're supposed to overturn a conviction on the straw man that the other person who offered up a threat might have been available? Perhaps the defense counsel checked him out and found that he had an ironclad alibi. Now that's not going to be in the record either.
If that's true, Your Honor, the defense counsel did not offer Charles Foster as a possible suspect in this murder in an opening statement. And it wasn't just Charles Foster that placed Mr. Coleman's possible interest in the case. John Cunningham, another drug dealer that Mr. Coleman had a warm body, was in the very alley where Mr. Coleman was killed at around the time of the murder. He still had the same motive and opportunity to kill Ms. Stevens, but his attorney never heard that. While the state's witnesses were completely inconsistent, their story changed every time they told them, and all of them had something to gain by going to anger at Tim Holtz.
What did Holtz have to gain, and why was that testimony not credible? The thing that impressed me about Holtz's statement was that all the way down to what the defendant was wearing, Holtz recognized the purple shirt, as I recall it. Why wouldn't that not be credible?
Holtz was not credible, Your Honor, for two reasons. First of all, Holtz did not recognize the final shirt that Coleman supposedly wearing. He said it had a hood. If you look at the final shirt in the record here in court, it doesn't have a hood on it. And the second thing to remember about Holtz is that he gave a very specific description to the police about the person who saw the woman in the scene, but he never told them that he saw Tim Coleman. That makes whether or not Tim Coleman was his woman in the scene, the story that Holtz told to the police to the police makes the testimony better. And the problem with the defense counsel's failure to include a possible alternative suspect, and the problem with their failure to impeach the state's witnesses, is that this is their opportunity to create reasonable doubt in mind of the jury. The state's case was built on the testimony of drug dealers, drug users, and convicted felons. They were biased, and their testimony was inconsistent with prior statements, and their testimony was inconsistent among the between judges. Further, there were...
Excuse me, where do we get the hood? We're talking about Chris Holtz, are we not?
Right.
The written statement, was there some, because I missed it, there was some oral communication about the hood. I don't find that in the written statement.
Mr. Holtz, in his cross-examination, says that
okay, because the statement he gave was the man was wearing a purple flannel shirt, and then it's in parentheses, white, whatever that means, but plaid, and I don't see anything about a hood, and this was his original statement, wasn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. When he testified as well, the whole did say that he thought that the flannel shirt had a hood,
and it was more like a jacket. Was he in jail at the time he gave this statement?
Your Honor,
I noticed the witness lists several of these people's addresses being the county jail.
Then he, as by, finished his case. And those possible perpetrators moreover, the failure to utilize as many opportunities to change the statement, to show who they were and what the inconsistencies in the statement were, the failure to present the other people in their story of the murder undermined confidence in the verdict. The jury never knew the whole story. They never knew that someone else was in the alley. They never knew that other people were threatening the statement. Therefore, they had no reason to doubt the state's version. The defense counsel had all of that information in their office to discover the process.
Do we need to go outside the record of this case, counsel, for support for the arguments with respect to ineffective assistance of counsel?
No, Your Honor. After a lot of the information that we point to on the inconsistency of the witness statement and the possibility of pointing to other perpetrators to change in the transcript
of the business record. There's an effort to add to this record after the trial, though, isn't it? Do we need to refer to that information that's supplied in the appendix?
That information is probably before the court because there's very specific information from the prosecutor that you can let you know if you need to see the information with Andrew Smith's counsel's office. We don't need to because there's specific exhibits and testimony from that. Your presentation.
May I interrupt you? Just one question. Would it ever be a good strategical move on behalf of defense counsel to make such statements in opening statements? I mean, we know it might be unethical, but make statements that really eventually couldn't support?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. I think that when you stand up before a jury, my client didn't do it, Charles Foster did it. The jury is expecting to see something
to produce.
That's entirely possible. It's also entirely possible that whoever committed this murder told them and they tried to change their tone. And also, informants that testified. They didn't come forward until well after the murder, and that's when they should have been made that as well. So there was 5%.
Pretty elaborate, though, isn't it? I mean, you would have us overturn the convention on a assumption that all of these things were somehow engaged in this elaborate conspiracy to tell a consistent story about what your client told us.
No, that's not why we have this court overturn the convention. Why we have this court overturn the convention is to repeat the verified. Then counsel has been involved in information that could have been for the state court system to drug dealers and theft. They had information that showed that these people were biased and interested. They had information that showed that they changed their joints from previous statements. All of that information could have been used by defense counsel to erode the credibility of the witnesses. Whether defense counsel had the opportunity to place another person in the alley with me to show that amount of time that the person was committed, this was an open opportunity to kill her. Defense counsel didn't do that. There were other drug dealers who could have committed this murder.
Are you claiming that the recitation of that evidence, none of that got to the jury at all?
Some of that did get to the jury, however, the problem is that you never had a down. There were opportunities that would happen.
So they were partially doing their job.
And if you were to see, they just went out and did the testimony. They did not, however, point out some very significant things. And while they did talk to the jury that another drug that was just committed in front of the child's office and drugs for another of other people, they never presented any evidence for it at the
end. Yes, to who it was.
Right. They never provided any information. When they had that in their office, they were communicating to these people who would have been placed in the office who would have actually threatened the community.
Did those
people
testify for the state?
No, they didn't. Defense counsel was called at that point to get that information on whether the sister would have known that there were other people threatening the community, but there were other people in the alley who would have confident upon defense counsel to create reasonable doubt in the case. They had the information, they knew what they needed to do, they simply did not. Defense counsel also knew the
evidence that the defense counsel didn't speak with these witnesses prior to trial.
No, we don't, Your Honor. I would hope that if the defense counsel had spoken to these witnesses and found out that they would have came out, that they would not have used that as a defense theory in their opening statement. Again, defense counsel offered trial to Officer and James Drew to possible alternatives of the suspect, as well as numerous others throughout the year. If the defense counsel, in fact, spoke to those witnesses and still offered them off without any defense, if they didn't speak to them, that would have affected as well. Either way, they could show they didn't speak to the officer. They also tried to call him a family to attempt to sever his blood and murder his family. This is a circumstantial case based on biased witnesses who were entering. They had inconsistent statements and there were other possible perpetrators. So in this instance, it was very important that the defense counsel attempt to sever that blood and murder his family because it necessitated proof of Coleman's 1993 conviction for drug trafficking. The problem with presenting of that information to the jury that is allowed to draw improper defense against the Coleman. Very targeted conversation in this case was simply related to the drug trafficking case. The fact that the jury was allowed to know that Coleman had been convicted by another jury before a prior drug trafficking charge allowed the jury to improperly infer that Coleman had a propensity to commit drug crimes, that he had committed drug trafficking before, therefore he likely did it in the
would it have been that point or some other point that you cited State v. Franklin to us as additional authority? Do you recall?
I don't recall.
State v. Franklin. You cited that to us as additional authority. And I was trying to, because I remember that case very well, and I thought maybe you had something specific that you wanted us to look at there.
No, we found that case out of the original, and I thought that it was possibly
wrong. On what, ineffective assistance of counsel, or the sufficiency of evidence, or
the joinder?
Good. Okay, thank you.
The language you're using, counsel, sounds like the plain error kind of standard that we use rather than the Strickland standard for ineffective assistance. You're saying he didn't get a fair trial or undermined confidence. We know, of course, you know very well what the standard is that we have to meet. So
there is a reasonable probability that by force
yes. Okay.
So we're not talking about, you know, and this court can't have confidence. The drug dealer and drug users can make a sound for life and testimony was convicted. There's no such thing. There's no confession or regret. No teaming up. No lies in testimony. It was solely on the word of those people that think someone was convicted. And couldn't have the fact about the opportunity to erode those rights.
Done a very effective job questioning this verdict and whether or not it was fair. I'd like to give you one more shot at me before you sit down, since you've concluded now. I'm still having trouble getting over the fact that I think it was Holt witnessed him walking into that alley with her. One of them, and the other witness said, or I guess maybe Holt said, he had a gun and he heard shots. And she's dead. And there was nobody else around. How do I get around that?
Your Honor, some counsel has done the wrong thing to have to get around that. Because John Cunningham and Nick Keene in that alley at around the time when Nick Keene was murdered. There were two people in that alley at around the time when he was murdered. It could have been John Cunningham who had lost the fire that shot John. And that should be around for both of them.
But the witness never said that there was more than one person there.
No,
Your Honor. He said he's always seen that he's driving for the same thing with her. And then at trial, he said that counsel should have discredited Holt.
Oh, yes, Your Honor.
So it's two things.
Because Holt has been on the also. Tim Holt doesn't make any of the same, but Holt's testimony is not credible, placing Tim Holt in a lonely
come.
Should counsel have made some note of the fact that the subject, that Chris Holt knows him, or knows the defendant, but doesn't say he knows him in his first statement, and then later says, yeah, I know him?
Well, what counsel did in that particular case, they got Christopher Holt to testify to the fact that he thought that this flannel shirt had a hood on it. And in fact, the flannel shirt that was introduced in evidence did not have a hood on it. And that was the limit then they had for going back to the jury later on during arguments saying you cannot rely on Christopher Holt because he told you there's a hood on this, and when in fact there is not. There is a difference in indicating to someone that you know somebody and yet being able to tell that person what their name is. And in fact, as I look at the court, I recognize faces, but perhaps sometimes it's difficult to say exactly what your name is. And so I don't know that that's a significant factor in his testimony that, yes, he knows Mr. Bowen. I think actually what the testimony is that he recognizes. But he doesn't know him all that well. And the thing is that Christopher Holt's testimony is reliable, and we know that it's reliable because of Timothy Coleman's statement in the police. He admitted to Sergeant Raver that he had been with Melinda that evening, that he had gone to Real with her to purchase some chicken wings for her. And in fact, that is where Christopher Holt initially sees Melinda and Tim Coleman together. He admitted to leaving Real Trips with Melinda and had a short conversation with her, and then at this point in the story he indicates that he goes down to a payphone and calls for a ride. Christopher Holt testifies when they left, and he followed them down the alley, and those three individuals, Christopher Holt, Melinda Stevens, and Tim Coleman, were the only individuals in that alley. That they turned around and proceeded back towards Riddle, and just a few minutes later he heard gunshots and he was walking home.
Who's this other person was supposedly in the alley?
You're referring to Christopher Holt's statement? I believe it's Christopher Holt's
statement. No, it's counsel's statement.
Oh, yeah, it's counsel's statement. There is nothing in the record that indicates there was any other individuals in that alley other than Christopher Holt, one of the people who was in the phone. John Cunningham's statement was not in evidence. It was not part of the record. Although he did admit to the police that shortly before the shooting that he saw Big T, which is Tim Coleman, and Melinda Stevens there at Riddle's outside, and he was talking to them, and they were waiting for some food.
Isn't that the problem that the defense counsel says that the trial defense counsel had that information and didn't offer it to the jury that there was, that Sean was in the in the alley or isn't that the place of the problem?
The only way that you can get that evidence in, because there are no independent witnesses that were able to place Sean McCrannan there at that scene. So the only way that you get that evidence in is if, as a defense counsel, you call Sean McCrannan to the scene and you get him to admit that he was there earlier in that evening and actually saw the defendant, Mr. Coleman, and Linda Stevens together, and that he left. And once he returned, the crime scene people were there and the murder had occurred. Not only that, but Sean Cunningham told the police officers who questioned him after this that the next day, Mr. Coleman came to him and admitted to him that he had been taking care of his business, consistent with the language that he had consistently used, that he was going to take care of his business and that he had to take care of his business. So I think it is a legitimate trial strategy at that point in time to defend counsel not to put Mr. Cunningham on the stand to say exactly what he told the police, which actually strikes him the same case in the matter. He put Mr. Coleman with the victim just before she shot, and he also tells us that Mr. Coleman has admitted to killing her, and that's when he says that he took care of his business. So I don't think it is professionally unreasonable to make the decision not to put this defendant on the stand, because that's the only way that you can get that evidence in. The same is true with Charles Foster. The only way that you get that testimony in, that he had threatened Melinda Stevens several days before this shooting, is to put him on the stand. And he readily admitted in his statement, which also I don't believe is good evidence, but did admit in his statement that he had made some general threats to her because he suspected her of being a threat informant, but denied killing her, and also Mr. Coleman told him after the fact that he's taking care of Melinda Stevens. Is professionally unreasonable under the standards and under the strictest test in the first part of that test, that trial counsel makes those decisions not to put those types of witnesses on the stand, which effectively strengthens the case the state is presenting against their client. It's not unreasonable in an opening statement to say, my client didn't do it, and in fact, there are a number of other individuals that could have done it, and in fact, that's what they did do. And in fact, counsel, instead of placing those individuals on to put that testimony on, during various stages, did try to cast some light as to these individuals, specifically in discussing or cross-examining Steve Gassler, who was an inmate who shared a cell for a day at the Corrections Center with Mr. Coleman, trying to elicit or at least plant in the minds of the jury that he was being housed in the same correctional facility as Charles Foster, as Sean Cunningham, as James Jordan, and some of these, and Jeff Beaver, some other individuals whose names came up during the course of the trial, at least then casting some light on the fact that Mr. Cashler learned this information from the real killer, quote unquote, being one of these individuals. There was a request made by defense counsel as to whether or not an offer would be made, and there was no offer made by the state of Ohio. So, with regards to the death penalty,
is it unreasonable defense tactic to make a statement like this? Defense attorney gave his own statement and then bring forth the witnesses to support it.
Well, defense counsel had an unusual opportunity that the state doesn't have. The state has the burden of proving each and every element of the crime. And when a prosecutor gets up and makes an opening statement as part of those elements and promises the jury something, because of the burden of proof on the state, you better deliver on that promise or you're going to be in trouble. You don't have the same burden as defense counsel because the defendant has no burden of proof whatsoever. Simply planting seeds sometimes can be sufficient.
Exactly. The defense counsel really, his job is to create a reasonable doubt.
Right. It's not necessary to prove that it was Charles Foster or that it was Sean Cunningham or that it was James Strick. Apparently, people that supposedly had a motive to kill one of the demons, and in fact, it's just the fact that it's not more so to show that any of those three did it. Not that it was one of those three, but that any of those three did it, thereby creating even more reasonable doubt, rather than being able to point to one specific person as an alternative killer in this matter. So I think that by planting those seeds, as counts did, and by doing so without having to go to the detriment of placing some of these individuals on the stand, they were effective in this matter. With regard to the weapons under disability charge, it is quite clear that counsel did not request that charge be severed, but there is good reason for that. It is clear that the law does favor joinder, and the weapons under disability charge arises out of the exact same fact as the aggravated murder charge itself. Mr. Coleman was charged with killing Melinda Stevens with prior calculations designed to prevent her testimony as a witness in an upcoming drug trial. And it was in the allegation of the state that he did so by putting two bullets in the back of her head. The weapon under disability charge arises from him having a firearm and then using it to commit this aggravated murder. So it does arise out of the same facts and circumstances as the aggravated murder charge. Under that standard, it is appropriate to try that case along with the aggravated murder charge. Part of what the state of Ohio had to prove in this matter was the death penalty specification when Linda Stevens was a witness against Timothy Coleman, and that she was a witness because she had purchased drugs from him, and as a result, she was going to testify concerning the three separate charges of aggravated trafficking in drugs. Because the state of Ohio had to prove that, the jury was going to be certainly familiar with the fact that we're talking about a drug dealer here. The fact that he had a prior drug conviction for which those specifics were given certainly doesn't add any additional pressure to Mr. Coleman's case in this matter.
It doesn't.
I fail to see how simply letting the jury know that he has a prior trafficking conviction, how that prejudices him more when there are certainly going to be allowed to hear that on three separate occasions.
It certainly lends credibility to the charges pending. Does it not?
No, it doesn't.
Doesn't.
I don't see how it lends any credibility to the fact that
doesn't the jury tend to believe that if the person on trial is charged with a crime and he committed that crime before, isn't there a tendency for the jury to believe the present crime?
There might be a tendency for that.
And isn't that prejudicial to the defendant?
It's not unfairly prejudicial.
What, wait a minute. Unfairly prejudicial. You mean you can have prejudice that is fair and prejudice that is unfair?
In a 403 balancing test, we look at the unfair prejudice to a criminal defense.
I just want to know, where is the fair prejudice?
Everything that is introduced into evidence if you're working on behalf of the state, is going to be prejudicial to a defendant and to the extent that it tends to prove an element of crime.
Well, that's what the prior conviction tended to do.
The prior conviction, I don't think, does tend to do that any more so than if they had not heard that.
Does it help the defendant?
It probably doesn't help him, but we also give the jury instruction as to what they're allowed to use that evidence for. Otherwise, if that was the case, we would probably never join any defenses, and that's simply not the law.
Shouldn't it have been the defense counsel's duty to try and keep that information from the jury and keep it out of the information going to the jury?
Had they made the motion to sever?
Yes.
under the law, as I understand, the judge then would make a decision as to whether or not to sever the defense.
Well, any,
he would not have abused his discretion.
Any judge worth being a judge knows that that would prejudice the defendant, and most likely would have been granted, would it not?
I don't think so. Under the current case law and jurisprudence, State v. Jenkins deals extensively with that issue and talks about the policy considerations of promoting judicial autonomy and when and in what circumstances it is proper to grant a severance and when it is proper to join those offenses together. The jury was properly instructed here to use this evidence. Granting a severance would have required the state to basically retry the aggravated murder case for the weapons under disability case as a fact and circumstances was so intertwined it would require two separate and almost identical trials.
Or it could have tried it to the court. Isn't that what usually happens?
I can't respond to what usually happens, but being on the defense side, or being on the prosecution side, I can't tell you what goes on in the mind of the defense attorney. But I don't think that under these circumstances, the prejudice is any greater than if he had been given a separate trial for the weapons under the disability.
About the defendant and his connection, if any, with the gun.
The gun was never recovered in this matter, and other than
what the shell casings were.
There were some shell casings that were recovered at the scene which matched the bullets that were removed from the victim in this matter. Because of the ballistic examination that was conducted by Mr. Shepard, he was able to determine that it was a 3/8 semi-automatic gun that was used, and that in all likelihood, because of the various characteristics on those bullets, it either was a government issued Colt or a DMC made. And the testimony due from other witnesses, including Coast Guard, she actually saw the gun within probably half an hour of the shooting, described it as being semi-automatic and it was silver in color. And Mr. Shepard testified that the DMC made does come from model as well as blue steel model. And finally, Mr. Coleman told
Who showed her the gun?
She saw the gun, Mr. Coleman, in his hand because he requested from her that she knew where the bullets were. She told him that she thought they were on top of the refrigerator. He went to get them, and then he proceeded to load the gun. She sees the gun and asked him what he's doing with that, at which time he responds, "I'm going to take care of it."
So there is some connection between the defendant and a gun.
Yes. Now, what actual gun was used?
Yeah, I understand that. They were all talking about, not all of them, but several about weapons and the guns. Was there any other, is there anybody else in this case that was connected in any way to any gun?
I don't believe there is anybody else that's connected.
Some of that testimony gets a little confusing. It sort of crosses over, and I was having trouble sorting that out.
I don't believe that other than that there was any other reference to placing the defendant with the gun. Your Honor, this court should uphold the conviction and sentence of death in this matter as the evidence is overwhelming as to Mr. Coleman's guilt, and also, and in this court's independent review, that the aggravating circumstances
matter substantially outweighed in the case of John. We have, of course, a full decision. Thank you, Stone. Coach, shall you stay a little over 4.5 minutes of your time?
Wouldn't have just called any of those witnesses have, I know we know the eventual outcome of the sealing of the fate of this defendant, but wouldn't it have just been all over after one of those witnesses testified for the Cunningham, the other one that you talked about? I was wondering why they weren't called too, but I could see I probably wouldn't call them. But that person was going to specifically say they weren't in the alley.
Well,
There was. After the fact, when he went back.
Is it likely that Sean would have testified if he'd been called that defendant told him that he was going to take care of her or taking care of her? I guess that's the fact that Sean, is that not, that's what counsel for the prosecution are you
testifying? Yes, I'm here to
So defense counsel then would have to make a judgment as to whether to put him on the stand and have him say that to the jury, wouldn't he? Wouldn't he have a judgment call that you could... You could come down both sides, huh? Both sides?
I don't think so. In that sense, we have a good case on the jury. Already heard from numerous witnesses that this woman has supposedly made those exact same statements. Sometimes the man wouldn't have added anything to that because the jury told what the jury already knew. But what he would have added was enough suspect with motive and opportunity within an hour at the time of the murder. That would have been counted
as a problem. Do you agree that? That he is the only person who would have put him in the alley?
Based on the information we have right now, yes, Your Honor. I don't know if the counsel has done an ongoing investigation. Somebody else might have seen something. But based on what we have right now, it would have been
submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The next case is 97-27-23.